This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Brooke Neindorf with you today for The Country Hour. Thanks for your company. Don't worry, Cassie Huff will also be joining us today, but she's headed to the Adelaide Hills to take a look at some of the latest in agri-tech. We're going across to her after 12:30. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can send us a text on 0467 922 891. We're also going to hear today about a record for SA Water that will see a whole lot more treated poo heading out to local farmers.
This year we are forecasting an estimated 90,000 tonnes of biosolids to be collected and reused by the state's primary producers. So typically on an average year we would see about 55,000 tonnes and our previous record was 86,000 tonnes. So this really is an extra step in achieving a great outcome for the environment and the community as a whole.
We'll hear more on that one shortly. But first today, in news that has just come through, Peninsula Ports, which is on the Eyre Peninsula, has secured funding to build a $250 million grain exports port at Port Spencer. Peninsula Ports Chair John Crosby joins us on The Country Hour today. Good afternoon, John.
Hey, Brooke.
Where has this funding come from?
We've secured it from a company called Aria Commodities, which is an international trading firm that trades in grain as well as other products and also has a large infrastructure investment fund.
What was their interest in coming on board?
They want to trade grain out of South Australia. They're currently traders in Western Australia and they see the advantage in also being able to operate out of South Australia.
With this funding, what does that mean when it comes to the building going ahead and when you're expecting to be operational?
We expect to start fairly soon. We're given that, as you might imagine, in a large field like this, there's a lot of legal contracts and what that have to be put in place. But we'd hope to be on site sometime in June, July. And we'd expect to be maybe not perfectly finished, but available to take grain for the November 23 harvest.
So for next year?
Yes, not this year, next year.
What could this mean for local growers?
More competition, a site which is much closer to a lot of grain. There's about 1 million tonnes of grain grown within 100 kilometres of the site. And it'll also, for the people of Port Lincoln, will have the effect of reducing somewhat the number of trucks that go through Port Lincoln.
I guess that means also for the broader community. What does that mean for the roads in the area?
Well, the amount of grain still gets carted on the roads now, and so the actual total amount of distance on roads will be less than what it currently is because we're 70 kilometres north of Port Lincoln and therefore that amount of road will get less traffic. But there is a need for what we would call an east-west road that goes across from the Todd Highway to the Lincoln Highway, and we're certainly working with government to see if that can be achieved.
John Crosby, in the past there has been concerns from some locals in the area. The proximity to a local penguin colony is one of those. What have you been doing in the last 12 months to address those concerns?
Well, they were all dealt with in the public environmental report, which was approved about 18 months ago.
So there's no concerns there from locals now?
Oh, well, I imagine there might be one or two of the locals that haven't been satisfied with what we put in place, but We are a reasonable distance from the penguins, well over 2 kilometres, and so we believe and we're able to convince the experts that they won't be affected by us.
There's also been concern from some Free Air shareholders, Free Air being the former parent company and proponent of Peninsula Ports, that they did not want this port to go ahead in this area. Are there still concerns being raised from them?
We haven't heard anything of that sort for some time. There may well be this announcement may well attract a few people to reactivate their concerns, but in every development, there are some people that don't like the development for their own personal reasons. That's totally fair and reasonable, and that's why we have an environmental process to get approvals through.
And John Crosby, just finally, there has been lots of discussion. We've got teaports already at Lucky Bay. Cape Hardy wants to come on board as well down the road with a port there. Has this been a race to get this funding and get this up and going?
Oh, obviously, those people that get started first, they get a major advantage in the whole process. Firstly, an advantage in being funded, but also an advantage in being on deck faster. Teaports have done a very, very effective job in getting going about 3 years ago. We congratulate them on that, but we see ourselves as being a really substantial competitor because of the proximity of grain to our site, and also the fact that ours is a very deep water site. It's able to take pretty much any size vessels that operate in the grain trade because it is just a naturally deep site.
John Crosby, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon to tell us about this announcement through Peninsula Ports.
Thank you.
That was John Crosby. He's the Peninsula Ports Chair. Let us know, what do you think of this this funding coming through and the potential for another port on the Eyre Peninsula? Send us a text 0467 922 891. You're listening to The Country Hour. Brooke Neindorf with you this afternoon.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, a key election battleground in previous federal elections is a quiet place for policy debate this campaign. The clock is still ticking on the Murray-Darling Basin plan, and a number of key decisions are yet to be made. National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan has written today that a reckoning is coming for the river system, but it's one part of the policy debate where major players don't necessarily agree along party lines.
The Murray-Darling Basin, it's Australia's largest river system, right? Taxpayers have committed $13 billion to get this plan right, which is probably more than we've spent on any other type of environmental reform. Not only is it a source of industry and economy, producing, I think, $24 billion of agricultural produce each year and something like $8 billion worth of tourism, it's home to more than 40 First Nations. More than 2.5 million people actually live in the Murray-Darling Basin. And yet it doesn't seem to be featuring heavily in this year's federal election.
Why do you think that is? Is that fatigue or something else?
Well, I think it's two main reasons. One, it's bloody complex and tricky. And two, it's rained.
So let's have a look at what's still to be decided and where policies may differ and votes may change in terms of this election.
Well, that's right, Woz. I mean, we're talking about a plan that was legislated with bipartisan support in 2012, 10 years ago. You'd think there wouldn't be that much to bicker and argue and differ about. And with just 2 years to go before major deadlines, these are water savings deadlines, must be met, it's looking like the whole thing is going completely off the rails, and there is in fact not going to be as much water recovered for the environment by June 2024 as what the legislated plan sets out.
Kath, you're right, Victorian Labor and the Federal Nationals are in lockstep. The Nationals and the Liberals are at odds with each other, and Federal Labor is promising to deliver more water for the environment by ignoring the state water minister's criteria, but working with the state. So effectively at odds with whatever state governments there are, including those from their own side of politics. It doesn't get murkier than that, does it?
It's really a hot mess, and we're talking here specifically about the 450 gigalitres of water, but there's another significant part of the Murray-Darling Basin plan that is also expected to be met by June 2024. This is 605 gigalitres of water savings that's meant to be found through different projects like re-engineering weirs or desilting lakes, things like that. And there is so much water to be recovered towards that target. It's a bit of a joke, really. I mean, the Menindee Lakes project might be one that you've heard about before. Last year, the federal government committed something like $300 million. This is $330 million taxpayer dollars to New South Wales to administer this project, to re-scope the Menindee Lakes project. Now, it was originally set up to recover 106 gigalitres of water for the environment. Like, that's a big project. That's a big chunk. The project never got off the ground. Last year, New South Wales announced it was re-scoping the project. And then Water Minister Melinda Pavey, a New South Wales Nat, said, don't expect this project to be delivered on time or the 106 gigalitres to be recovered. She didn't put a figure on it at that time, but one industry insider has told me it's more likely to be something like 40 gigalitres. So that's a bit of a shortfall in anyone's language. And another one of these projects that's meant to contribute to the 106 target is known as constraints management. Now, this would require something like 4,000 landholder agreements to take place, effectively organising with each landholder, predominantly farmer, along different parts of the basin, so that flooding arrangements might be made or various impacts on private land. Something like 4,000 agreements are required was. Today, not one has been reached. I'm not even joking. That's zero landholder agreements in a 4,000 landholder agreement project that's to be reached in just 2 years' time. David Littleproud, now the Agriculture Minister, another Queensland Nat, formerly a Water Minister, did actually say recently that he thought that the deadlines for the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, if they need to be extended, they should be extended. Now, that's again at odds with the Liberal South Australian senators who say in full and on time. And the other point, just to go back to the 450 gigalitres of water, I forgot to make this really important point, Warwick. Of that 450 gigalitres that must be recovered by June 2024, just 2 gigalitres has been recovered.
So we're in this situation where the basin plan is not or highly unlikely of being completed on time, and decisions still need to be made on how much more water is gained for the environment. What happens from here, Kath?
Well, Warwick, that's pretty much anybody's guess. I get the sense at the moment that anything could happen, and I know that there are communities from the top of the basin right to the bottom who are living with a lot of uncertainty. But you definitely get the sense that despite having a legislated plan in place for 10 years this year, there still seems to be plenty that could chop or change.
That was National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan speaking to Warwick Long. Brooke Neindorf with you for the Country Hour, but don't worry, Cassie Huff will be with us in the second half of the program. But before we get to her, let's have a look at some interesting stuff here. A record-breaking 90,000 tonnes of biosolids, which is a byproduct of treated human poo, will be collected and reused by South Australian farmers. The biosolids are in high demand across the state as farmers look for ways to improve the quality of soil for dryland crops. The product is collected by SA Water and comes from right across SA. SA Water's Senior Manager of Production and Treatment, Lisa Hannett, says it's an important way forward for sustainability.
And we're very excited to see that record tonnage of biosolids being sent out to our South Australian farmers. So this year we are forecasting an estimated 90,000 tonnes of biosolids to be collected and reused by the state's primary producers. So typically on an average year we would see about 55,000 tonnes, and our previous record was 86,000 tonnes. So this really is an extra step in achieving a great outcome for the environment and the community as a whole.
So is there more of this biosolids around? Is that why there is that record, or is it because more farmers are asking for it?
It is because more farmers are asking for it. It is in high demand. We actually have a bit of a stockpile that we have had sitting at our Bolivar wastewater treatment plant. And to be able to deliver the 90,000 tonnes, we are eating into that stockpile. So the demand is very high right now.
Now, it is a sort of around breakfast time and people might be listening to this, or lunchtime for the Country Hour, but can you tell us what biosolids actually are?
Yes. So biosolids, as you alluded to, are actually a byproduct of treating poo. So they are a highly treated product, though, and it is a safe method of reusing human sewage for the benefit of the environment. But what actually are they? So wastewater from our customers goes through a screening plant and an aeration process at a wastewater treatment plant. And through that process, the solids or the sludge and liquid are separated. We then use a process known as anaerobic digestion, where any organic matter that is in the sludge is broken down, and that then heads out to some drying lagoons to dry and stabilise before becoming what we call biosolids. So it is quite a rigorous process, and it is highly regulated by the EPA, and absolutely the product is safe to use.
And so farmers use it just out in the paddocks, is that that's what they use it for?
Yes, exactly right. So the farmers use it as a, it's a valuable resource and a helpful tool for them to improve soil quality. So the biosolids would typically be applied to dry land crops such as cereals or to irrigated permanent crops such as citrus or vines. And it really is the nutrients in the soil that add great, in the product, sorry, that add great value to the soil.
And so this record that's been broken, I was reading that last time it was that 86,000 tonnes that you spoke about was back in 2007, 2008, I believe.
Yes.
So what is it about this year, do you think? Have farmers said why they are wanting more of it this year?
Well, I think because of the nutrient value in the product, we know that the price of phosphorus in particular is quite high. So this is a great source of gaining that phosphorus, for example. And the product for farmers is actually free. So we're happy to give it away so long as, I guess, you know, it goes to a really positive environmental outcome.
So if farmers want these biosolids, what do they actually do to collect it?
So farmers, we work with transporters who will come to our Bolivar site and collect up the biosolids into a truck, and they will transport it out to a farmer's paddock where it will be spread across the land and it goes from there.
Are there particular regional sites that SA Water have got that you collect biosolids from as well that can add to this tonnages?
Yes, there is. So actually a big part of being able to meet this growing demand that we're seeing at the moment has been SA Water's ability to collect more biosolids from places like the Adelaide Hills, where we have a number of wastewater treatment facilities as well as Port Pirie and Port Augusta. So we've transferred some biosolids from those regional sites down to Bolivar, where they can be, I guess, collected in one location and processed ready for transport out to farms.
SA Water's Senior Manager of Production and Treatment, Lisa Hannan. So with the price of synthetic fertilisers skyrocketing and sustainability becoming a bigger focus for many farmers, the organic alternatives like biosolids are looking more viable. Sydney Water, which is the New South Wales equivalent to SA Water, currently supplies around 30 farms in New South Wales with the treated sewage, and John Toole is one of them. He farms near Bathurst, and he told Hannah Josie the material has been a boon for his pastures.
There is no comparison whatsoever. Bang for buck, certainly the biosolids is more expensive first up, but you get the results are so much better, it's unbelievable. I believe it's the equivalent of probably 5 or 6 years of fertiliser.
In 1 year of biosolids?
In 1 year. And honestly, I've got paddocks over here that I can't put sheep in. It's just too high. The grass, the pasture that was sown in 2019, yeah, it's just unbelievable.
So there are some conditions with using the material, like they have to be spread within a certain number of days and then incorporated in the soil within a certain number of hours. Does that all make it a bit more difficult to use?
It's really not a problem at all, because I think it's only a 30-day withholding period, but you think about it, once you've ploughed it in, you're not going to have any crop up to eat within the 30 days anyway. So it's, I really can't see a problem with it at all.
Any other problems in using the biosolids, like odour or anything like that?
Oh, it's definitely got an odour, like you can't get away from that, but it seems to be improving each year. The neighbour was using it, I'm guessing now, 10 years ago, and it was really quite strong, but now it's not too bad at all. Once you plough it into the ground, it seems to dry, to take the moisture out of it, and the smell is pretty much gone almost straight away.
That was Bathurst farmer John Toole speaking with Hannah Josie. I'd like to know, are you using biosolids yet in your paddock? You can send us a text, 0467 922 891. What has it meant for you? Has it seen your crops grow, your pastures get higher? Let us know. We'd love to hear if you are using it. Now, it's that time of the day where we find out what's happening with the weather, and we're joined by Tom Bowick from the Weather Bureau. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, Brooke.
Now, I'm here in Port Lincoln, and it's quite sunny, and it sounds to be the case in a lot of parts of South Australia. Is this rain coming anytime soon?
Yes, look, certainly on the mild side at the moment, with looking at the temperatures throughout the state, almost everywhere sort of is in the low to middle 20s type of range, and winds are generally northwesterly, somewhat fresh ahead of this change. If you do happen to have access to a satellite picture at the moment, you'll see that there is quite a sharp delineation of a cold front sort of moving towards Kangaroo Island and the Lower Eyre Peninsula. It's still a fair way off off the coast at this stage, but we are expecting that as we move into this sort of by the late afternoon, you'll start to see some shower activity sort of moving into the Lower Eyre Peninsula as that front moves into that area, and also starting to move into Kangaroo Island as well. And the future of all that is that those showers are expected to be sort of near the southern and western coasts sort of later today and into the evening, and they'll extend over the remainder of the agricultural area during this evening, except for probably the Riverland not quite reaching that far north. And the showers should grade from a slight to medium chance in the west and the north up to a high to very high chance, or increasing to a high to very high chance for the southern agricultural area. The milder conditions will also be coming to an end, so becoming cooler throughout in the south, grading to mild in the north during this evening. And the winds will be shifting sort of southwesterly in the south as the front comes through. Now into Wednesday then, we do have a cold pool of air moving over the state in the wake of that cold front. That'll see a high to very high chance of showers over the agricultural area, tending to a medium chance in the far north of the agricultural area and also over the west coast district, with just a slight chance of showers moving into the far south of the pastoral districts. With that cold air, there's a possibility of some small hail in the lower southeast and also near the southern coasts. Temperatures much cooler, cool to cold, grading to mild in the far northeast, with winds fresh southwest to southerly. On Thursday is probably the day that the coldest air is over the state, so that'll see still a high to very high chance of showers for the southern agricultural area. That high to very high chance also moving near the Gulf Coasts and also the mid-north ranges, tending to just a slight to medium chance of showers for the remainder of the northern agricultural area and the western coasts. We do have the possibility of some small hail for the Mount Lofty Ranges, southwest Murraylands and the southeast districts, and there's possible thunderstorms for the southeast district. Southeast districts as well. Sheep graziers warning has also been issued for Wednesday and Thursday. Into Friday then, still some showers for the southern agricultural area and near those Gulf Coasts. Just a slight to medium chance of those showers for the northern agricultural area and near the western coasts. Then the trend for Saturday and into the remainder of the weekend and early next week is for a sort of gradual easing of those showers. Probably still looking at a high to very high chance of showers for your southern coasts, the southern Mount Lofty Ranges and the lower southeast district on Saturday. And temperatures will be remaining in the cool to cold range in the south right through until early in the weekend. The longer term outlook for Sunday through to Tuesday is well, there'll be a slight to medium chance of showers near the coast, but there'll be clearing in the west on Sunday and throughout on Monday. Tuesday should be dry throughout, apart from just a slight chance of showers developing in the far northeast of the state on Tuesday, and becoming less cold, I suppose, cool to mild for Sunday to Tuesday, with generally light southeast to northeasterly winds. Now, cumulative rainfall totals expected period until midnight on Saturday, looking at 5 to 15 millimetres for the southern agricultural area, also near the Gulf Coasts and the mid-north ranges, 1 to 5 millimetres for the remainder of the northern agricultural area and also the remainder of the west coast district, less than 1 millimetre over the south of the pastoral districts. We do, however, have some higher totals forecast in the range of 15 to 30 millimetres for the southern Mount Lofty Ranges, also for parts of the southern coasts and the southern parts of the lower southeast district. So, looking like a pretty cold sort of outbreak coming through for the Wednesday and particularly Thursday period there. Likely most locations will be seeing the coldest day of this year so far, with the cold air coming through. So it's back to you, Brooke.
Thanks very much. That was Tom Bowick from the Weather Bureau. Let's have a look at the Western Inlands for today. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny, high chance of showers in the far east, most likely in the morning and afternoon. Chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast and light winds becoming southwesterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour in the morning. Overnight temperatures falling to between 9 and 15, with daytime temperatures reaching the low to mid-20s. For the Lower Western, partly cloudy, a high chance of showers in the far east, slight chance elsewhere, chance of a thunderstorm in the far east in the morning and afternoon. Overnight temperatures falling to around 10, with daytime temperatures reaching between 18 and 23. Coming up, we're going to cross to Cassie Huff, find out what she's been up to this afternoon.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Brooke Neindorf. Brooke Neindorf.
Hello, thanks for joining me today. Cassie Huff will still be with you as well. She'll be on a little bit later in the show. She's headed to the Adelaide Hills for a special AgTech event. Now, it's a workshop ahead of the Oceania 2035 Summit that's being held in New Zealand later this year. It's all about how agriculture can be help provide solutions to climate change. It's an offshoot of the COP26 event that you might remember in Glasgow last year. And a lot of exciting speakers are here today. So Cassie will give you a sense of how South Australia can play a role, from the very publicised investment in hydrogen to the pride of South Australia, the wine industry. We're going to cross to Cassie very shortly to find out more. But before that, let's get the latest from the newsroom with Emma Revelato. Good afternoon, Emma.
Good afternoon. State Parliament's back for the first time since the March election, and the new Labor government has backed the return of controversial Liberal figure Terry Stevens to President of the Upper House. He was forced to give up the role 2 years ago because of an ICAC investigation. The DPP later decided not to press charges. And all eyes were on former Deputy Premier, Liberal Vicky Chapman. She's been sworn in as MP, despite questions over whether she can be there or not because of when she wants to resign. Everyone's waiting to see what the Reserve Bank will do with interest rates. We'll find out in about an hour and a half if rates will go up for the first time since 2010. The Coalition's trying to downplay any political implications of a rate hike, while Labor concedes rates will go up irrespective of who is in government. South Australia's recorded just over 3,200 new cases of COVID-19, while a woman in her 90s and two men in their 80s who tested positive have died. There are 228 people in hospital with the virus. And the fashion world is focused on New York right now for the Met Gala. Actor Blake Lively's worn a gown that changed colour, while Kim Kardashian wore Marilyn Monroe's dress, the one she wore when she sang Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy. We'll have more news at 1.
Thanks very much for that, Emma. It has some interesting fashion that gets about at the Met Gala. I have to go and check out some of those photos after the program. Brooke Neindorf with you in the studio seat for today. We're talking about biosolids a little earlier in the program. And we had a text come through from Greg. He said, well done to Mick and his team at Bolivar for the professional operation they run. A pleasure to cart from. So thanks for the text, Greg. But let's now head to the Adelaide Hills, where Cassie Huff is joining us from. She's out and about. She's at a workshop ahead of the Oceania 2035 Summit. Good afternoon, Cassie. It sounds like it's been a pretty interesting morning already.
Absolutely, Brooke. This is a wonderful conference. You're hearing from the who's who of agritech in South Australia, and it's a beautiful day to be in the Adelaide Hills ahead of this cold change that is expected to come across the state. Now, there's about 100 people here today, and they're involved in all facets of agritech, and Peter Wren Hilton is a particularly important guest. He's actually the founder and executive director of AgriTech New Zealand, and he's going to be the convener of the 2035 Oceania Conference. It's the Oceania Agri-Food Tech 2035 Conference, which is an offshoot of COP26, the climate conference in Glasgow last year, which you might have heard a lot about. Now, it's the reason for the event that we're at today, this event that's being held in New Zealand later in the year. But to find out how the two work together and how all of this is working to develop ag tech in Australia and indeed the world, I'm joined by the convener, Peter Wren-Hilton. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
So how does this meeting here of about 100 people in South Australia, in the Adelaide Hills, Harndorf, how does that play into the work that you're doing on a global scale and through this Oceania 2035 conference?
Really closely. And I think the reason for that is that the challenges that we face are actually very similar. As you said, I'm from New Zealand, but the challenges facing farmers and growers in this country are very much the same as those in New Zealand. And what the summit in October is designed to do is to try and identify ways in which we can support farmers and growers reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Agriculture is responsible for anywhere between 23 and 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And what this conference is designed to do is to find the tools and the technology to help farmers reduce those emissions, but also continue to produce food profitably and sustainably in a changing climate. And what we're trying to do is pull together stakeholders, particularly from New Zealand and Australia, researchers, government agencies, industry, startups, investors, to see how we can collaborate to make that happen.
You've got a broad gamut of people here, everything from remote sensing to carbon farming to how there's solar applications of all sorts of different people are being canvassed here today. What are going to be the priorities, do you think, for agritech going forward?
Well, I think actually addressing some of the climate issues is going to be one of the biggest priorities that we've got, because there's no doubt the global population is increasing exponentially. By 2050, we need to produce 40% more food to feed approximately 10 billion people. And yet we're doing that in an environment which is being increasingly impacted by climate change. You only need to go to Australia's east coast at the moment to see the impact of floods and rain. My last visit here before COVID was in December 2019. And then I remember being woken up in Canberra and Sydney by the smell of smoke as parts of New South Wales burnt. And so that is evidence that the fact that climate change is happening, it's urgent, and we need to take actions to address it now.
And you're from New Zealand. New Zealand farmers perhaps have a little more motivation to look at some of the technology involved in climate change. Can you explain what that is and why?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So by the end of this year, the end of 2022, every farm in New Zealand must state its greenhouse gas emissions. It then has 3 years until 2025 to build into its farm management plans how it intends to reduce those gas emissions. And that's because in 2025, we'll be introducing something called ETS, the Emission Trading Scheme. And farmers will effectively be taxed if they're not effectively reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. So for New Zealand farmers, it's critically important to identify those tools and technology to enable them to reduce those emissions before, or at least begin that process before 2025.
New Zealand's obviously a much smaller country than Australia. Do you see that sort of impetus on farmers coming to somewhere like Australia where, I mean, you've got maybe a couple of hundred hectares in New Zealand for farms, whereas we've got millions in some cases?
Yeah, and it goes back to that very first point. I think the challenges we face are exactly the same. It doesn't really matter on the scale and size of your holding. If you're generating greenhouse gas emissions, then that's still going to impact not just locally, but climate change doesn't recognise borders. If you continue to produce greenhouse gas emissions, that impacts everybody. So I don't think size per se is a challenge. I think it's more ambition. I think that's possibly where this conference today has been hugely encouraging for me, to see just how ambitious people within the agritech sector in South Australia are to address this issue.
What are you seeing here in South Australia and indeed Australia that excites you the most?
I think basically the range of technologies being adopted. So we're seeing technologies ranging from, you know, artificial intelligence to machine learning, the use of space. So clearly South Australia is host to the Australian Space Agency. Understanding how satellite data can help farmers understand more about the carbon in their soil and their water. It's this configuration of different technologies which is really exciting. And the science and research that I've seen today really underscores that.
And when we were talking about some of the initiatives that the New Zealand farmers are looking at, and there was a reluctance, I guess you were saying at the start, with what it would end up costing, but when you see markets, particularly in Europe, prepared to pay more for a product that is considered clean, which includes some sustainability elements to it as well. But you've got this at a time, that motivation at a time when food inflation is increasing enormously as well, and it's making food more climate change mitigation methods and things like that could be making food more expensive at a time when food is increasing a lot. How do you see those two issues playing off against each other or potentially cancelling each other out? How do you see that working?
That's a great question. And going back to the first point that you made, though, I listen to farmers frequently talk about how they define, you know, their premium product. And, you know, Australian beef farmers are rather like New Zealand beef farmers. We believe that we produce the best beef in the world. And that's around taste and texture.
Except that Australia's all right.
That's around taste and texture. But increasingly, global consumers are also looking at carbon footprint. And that will also ultimately be priced into what we can sell our product for. And so in October, at the summit in Auckland, we'll be hearing from some of the big supermarkets in Europe talk about what their definition of carbon neutral means. And we'll begin to get a better understanding as to just how favourable they will be towards our produce based primarily on its carbon footprint as well as its taste and texture. So I think that's going to become an increasingly important consideration for farmers. And certainly in New Zealand, farmers who 3 or 4 years ago were concerned about the cost and the regulation and the compliance around climate are now much more tuned into the economic impact of failing to reduce that carbon footprint, because if they don't, then the rest of the world may simply stop buying our produce.
But is there a point where it will get too expensive?
Well, that again is a very, very valid point. We've always tried to argue that we want to produce nutritious, affordable food. But whether one can actually produce in volume and reduce carbon footprint, that is something that I think that we're really looking towards agritech and food technologies to help us support that.
I'm sure that's something that will come up as part of the Oceania 2035 Agri-Food Conference in New Zealand. Thank you so much for your time today. I know you've got to get back upstairs to the conference, so I'll let you go. But we'll keep moving on here because there's a lot of wonderful speakers here today. That was Peter Wren-Hilton there, the founder and executive director of Agritech New Zealand. But Martin Cole is with the Australian wine industry. He's the CEO of Wine Australia. And when it comes to climate change, the wine industry is considered a bit of a canary in the coal mine, really seeing the effects perhaps before other industries will see as pronounced effects. And it's perhaps a role that or an industry that's an element to the industry that Martin Cole is learning a bit about, because you've only just come into the job, I believe. How have you found it?
Yeah, good to see you again, Cass. Yeah, no, look, it's been a baptism of fire, really. I mean, we're almost in the perfect storm in terms of the operating environment, a really tough operating environment with the loss of the China market, COVID-19, closing the on-premise market. And then on top of that, you know, all of the issues in terms of really getting sustainability credentials and things like that. So, yeah, we're not short of things to talk about in the sector at the moment.
Absolutely. And given that South Australia produces the most wine in this country, there's a lot of work in this space, particularly happening in South Australia. You've come into this role. Where are you seeing the most gains being made when it comes to an agri-tech point of view?
Well, I think really the big thing that we're going to see is, I think innovation, the real impact of innovation used to be, you know, at the farm or the paddock scale. And really what we need to see is really the big step change will be through the value chain and actually looking at that. So, you know, the thing you're just talking with Peter in terms of the, you know, the market, the sort of demands that the market are placing on our products at the moment, that it's almost going to be a cost of doing business in terms of that sustainability credentials. I think the real trick as well would be to kind of also look at the technology and the good management practices that you're going to need for sustainability. Also, you know, kind of going to drive efficiency and profitability. I mean, that's really what we want to try and unlock, both sustainability but also get some profitability back to the sector.
And this hasn't come up so much today, but I know you've got your sustainability label that is often being placed on bottles of wine. Are you seeing much change in consumer behaviour as a result of that? I know this is a bit of a question off topic, so I understand if you haven't had much to do with it.
No, I mean, we're particularly from Europe. The retailers in Europe, the Nordic countries, those markets are really demanding those sort of sustainability credentials, particularly the younger generation too. We're calling it the rise of the ethical consumer. They're sort of demanding to see those sorts of things. I think the market's probably a little bit ahead of the consumer. I mean, we still predominantly buy food and wine on price and taste and quality and then sustainability. But if you look at the change in the trends there, sustainability is certainly growing. The demand for sustainability is growing. So we're really seeing as that we need to be on the front foot there, and we've got a great story. You know, we want to make sure we've got a great story to tell from our products from here, from Australia.
So what are you doing?
Well, we're laying out with our sustainability, our sustainable wine growing Australia. That's a scheme that really is about, it's a certification scheme. Mm-hmm. That's about, you know, kind of the ability to benchmark and to share best practice, and really looking at a whole range of indices there across water use, energy use, carbon footprint, waste, etc. I think what we're looking to do is where do we take that as well then? How do we take that forward now and make sure that the metrics we're using there internationally recognised, and that, as I say, we've got that credentialing that we can that really hold our own in international markets.
And how is the transition from that more conceptual research technology that's being developed to actually being deployed in the vineyards? How is that going?
Yeah, look, I've seen some amazing adopters of some of the technology. You know, I've seen some of our producers and our wine growers and winemakers just doing some amazing things in terms of technology adaptation and adoption from energy, you know, kind of generating energy on farm renewables, water treatment, the whole, you know, precision agriculture, looking at you know, precision vine growing, etc. So whole range of things, really. What we want to do is to try and make sure that we do that in a way that I think hopefully brings everybody along, and that we do some sharing of best practice there with around a, you know, kind of whole of value chain strategy for sustainability.
And you made a comment in your presentation today that you came into this job thinking that there was obviously jobs that need to be done, but the speed at which it needed to be done was something that you've changed your mind on in the last few months or since you've come into the job. What made you make that change, and what do you think now needs to be done from a speed point of view?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, seeing what's happening in international market, this operating environment we're in, it feels like things are coming at us faster and faster. So even just three or so months ago, we wouldn't be talking about inflationary pressures because of a war in Europe. So that's now putting pressure. So the global food price index is now as high as it was in 2008. So that's usually linked to energy prices. So things are coming at us, things are changing, market demands are changing. So we've got to really look at how do we speed some innovation and do that at scale and do it in a way that's co-designed with the industry.
Well, your industry, I think, as I said, is ahead of the curve in terms of feeling the effects of some of these changes. Grapes really are changing. They're ripening earlier. There's grapes that are no longer viable in some areas because of the warming climate in some places. So there's certainly been a lot documented on the wine industry and how it's having to adapt to changes in the climate. So it's not an easy task, but thanks so much for sharing some of your thoughts with me today.
Good to see you, Cass. Thanks.
That was Martin Cole, the CEO of Wine Australia, speaking there about the wine industry's take and the agri-tech that will be involved in adjusting to some of the changes that the industry is facing when it comes to climate. I'm Cassie Huff and I'm broadcasting from the agri-tech event in the Adelaide Hills. That's an offshoot of the 2035 Oceania Agri-Food Tech Conference that's going to be held in New Zealand in a few months, in the second half of the year, and it is 12 minutes to one.
Come over to the sunny side now. Australia, a great place for families. Opportunity for you.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
The South Australian government is trying to bring back backpackers, and they're doing it by incentivising, subsidising, paying for the rest of their ticket. So is it going to make a difference? Is this the key that could turn things around in what's been a pretty shaky few years?
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Cassie Huff and you are listening to The Country Hour. I'm broadcasting live from an ag tech event in the Adelaide Hills today, where there's been a lot of fascinating presentations about just where South Australia is fitting into the global agri-tech solutions to a myriad of problems and opportunities facing ag going forward. And one that's received quite a lot of publicity in recent months, particularly in relation to elections, has been hydrogen production and the role that South Australia can play in that. I mean, there was the state government putting forward, I think, almost $500 million towards some of the hydrogen projects in this state, and now there's bipartisan support from the federal government as well for some investment into hydrogen in this state. So it's very much an industry that is seen as has a lot of potential in South Australia. And Quentin Roberts is the co-founder of South Australian Hydrogen, and he's been looking at this for some time. Good afternoon.
G'day. How are you, Cass? Nice to be
here. Welcome to this program. So hydrogen is having a bit of a moment at the moment. We've talked a lot about it in recent weeks with the various elections, but you in particular are looking at developing, you've got hubs right across the state. Can you let people know what's happening on the ground at the moment, not just the future-funded the projects that we've heard about recently?
Yeah, there's a lot happening. In fact, down at the Tonsley Innovation Precinct, for example, we currently have Australia's largest electrolyser. So that's producing hydrogen, and they're feeding it into the local natural gas grid at the moment at a blend of 5%. And there's a whole series of other projects that have been planned. And we use the term hub to talk about an aggregation of projects generally around a geographical region. So you would have heard about the Upper Spencer Gulf announcements recently, Port Bonython, Whyalla, for example. We've got one we're developing around Roseworthy. Outer Harbour is the one that we're about to start developing. And we also do a lot of work in the mobility space. So we're looking at developing a hydrogen refueling network across the state as well. So a lot of activity.
Absolutely. And just you mentioning the refueling there, one part of your presentation alluded to hydrogen tractors. Now, this has been an idea for some time, but it's never really, it hasn't quite become a reality yet, but it sounds like that's changing. What's happening in the hydrogen tractor space in South Australia?
Yeah, well, we're trying to accelerate that change for sure. I mean, there are European manufacturers that are starting to create hydrogen engines, so that's hydrogen internal combustion, but most commonly we see them as a fuel cell. So basically that's reversing the electrolysis process, so bringing the hydrogen and oxygen back together and creates energy, and then you can have your drive and energy creator there. So around the Roseworthy hub, one of the activities we're looking at is retrofitting a fuel cell into a tractor and be able to run some trials on that. And obviously it's a good access point to the agricultural region through there. So that's why we're working on that.
So does that mean that a conventional tractor could actually be transformed into using hydrogen as the fuel source?
That's what we're looking to test. So it's a conceptual project, but yeah, we'll need our research partners and our other trial partners to bring that all together. But that's just one of the many projects that we're looking at around there. But there's also the broader picture about transport in general. So we can see this, you know, there'll be hydrogen prime movers, for example. You know, there might be hydrogen trains in the marine sector. So anywhere where there's a lot of run hours in the vehicles, so that long-haul type transport, and, you know, tractors obviously doing a lot of run hours. So, yeah, it's a really good application for hydrogen.
How do you see the work you're doing with these hubs, working in with these massive projects that have been government-funded?
Well, those massive projects are part of the hubs. So, and that's the benefit of the hub sort of concept. So you need those, your bigger pillar projects, and then some of the other smaller ones can leverage off of that, and that's how you'd really generate the scale. So that's very much at the heart of what we're doing. I mean, we love to see that investment. Obviously, those announcements we've seen even over the last week around Whyalla and Port Bynithon are a great accelerator for the industry. You would have heard about the state government's plan here as well for that region, so, which is a very bold target, but we acceleration is the point. The climate really needs us to accelerate this clean energy transition. Hydrogen is a really important part of that. So, yeah, we need those big pillar projects, but you know, that's not to mean we don't forget about the smaller ones as well. So as a cluster and a hydrogen association, that's what we're looking to do, is to bring all of that together, to bring industry together, facilitate that collaboration so that acceleration at scale can really take place.
In 5 years' time, where do you see hydrogen in South Australia?
Well, I'd like to see an established framework for a hydrogen refueling system, so I would expect it's starting to integrate into some of those long-haul transport routes. So that's what we're working on scoping up right now. So, and I expect that the integration of hydrogen in terms of blending into natural gas networks, that would be increased as well. So it's at a smallish scale at the moment, but I expect that to expand as well. And then just the other application areas of hydrogen, I'm seeing the export potential really accelerate as well. So I'd be expecting those supply chains to be much stronger than they are today. So, yeah, this is not a 10 or 20-year prospect. We're talking, yeah, in the years for this to happen.
And there's so many offshoots for agriculture as well. I know that farmers have been involved, perhaps looking at green hydrogen production and what that could mean from a fertiliser point of view. There's all sorts of applications going forward. It's certainly a very interesting space, and it's one that South Australia seems to be at the fore of as well. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, absolute pleasure.
Quentin Roberts there, who is with Hydrogen South Australia. Now, before I let you go, we're talking about all sorts of different projects that have been canvassed here at the conference today, but it all needs money, and that's where my final guest comes into play. Matt Pryor from Tenacious Ventures is involved in early stage investment in some of these projects. Good afternoon.
Hey, Gessie.
So, where do you fit in? If someone's got an idea, perhaps they've done some research with the university to prove up the concept. Where do you fit in?
Yeah, I guess we fit in identifying ideas that have global opportunity. An early frustration of mine as actually founder of an ag tech company was I would go to meetings internationally and hear all these conversations about all this amazing stuff taking place, and I knew there was so much happening in Australia, and there were no other Australian companies in those rooms, and so we really have to find ways to take what we're doing here and get it up to global scale.
And we've got all these projects, but you are keen on also expertise and exporting that. How would that fit in with this move towards ag tech?
Yeah, when you think about the origins of ag tech in Australia, it really has come out of our agricultural research system. The reason we have an agricultural research system is Australia's a pretty challenging place to conduct agricultural production. And so we've invested decades to build up this body of knowledge. Now, originally we did that to make Australian farmers more efficient, more productive, which is fantastic, and we have that great base, and hopefully we can reach that $100 billion figure and more, but there's literally billions and billions of people who need to be fed, and doing that in the face of, you know, increasingly variable climate is a global problem. And we have all this expertise. We can only make so much food, but there's an unlimited opportunity for us to turn that knowledge into new products and new services and export those.
So Australia hasn't always been good at that, though. We're good at pulling things out of the ground. We're not always so good at the later stages. How do you see that transition happening?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, it's an attitude shift. And I think two sort of trends. One is it's definitely an attitude shift where we need to think in addition, right? Not by exception, or not that we make less agricultural produce. We can continue to grow our agricultural productive system. But in addition to that, create these new companies. I mean, there are now a lot of really good examples of Australian startups who have gone on and taken on the world. And, you know, simple examples in tech would be Canva and Atlassian and companies like that. We can do the exact same thing in ag tech, in agri tech, in food tech, whatever you want to call it.
Do we undermine our advantage, though, by exporting it?
That is such an important question. And I think, again, that goes to mindset. It is absolutely true that the RDC system is significantly funded by farmer levies, and it also has to be true that Australian farmers are the primary beneficiaries of that research. But to think that we can kind of hold on to that to cement that advantage, I think, is the wrong approach to seeing how farmers can benefit. What we want is to be on the leading edge of new ways for farmers to benefit.
Well, it's a huge conversation that I'd love to continue with Matt Pryor from Tenacious Ventures, but that's all we have time for today, and I'll be with you back tomorrow. Otherwise, thanks, Brooke.
No worries. Thanks very much, Cassie. That is all we've got time for on The Country Hour for today. Thanks very much for joining us on the program. Cassie Harf will be back in the studio seat from tomorrow. Have a good afternoon. It's news time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.